Welcome to Trade Talk Africa, a Pan-African podcast about trade, trends, and investment opportunities. In this episode, we speak with Richard Biarugaba, the Managing Director of the National Social Security Fund in Uganda. The NSSF is the largest public pension fund in East Africa, with assets of close to $4 billion. In this episode, we explore what 2021 might look like based on the changes induced by the pandemic and some of the pre-existing trends across the region. Richard, you're welcome.
You're welcome, Richard.
Thank you so much for having me.
So my first question to you, Richard, and thank you once again for joining us, is that at the beginning of the pandemic, there were debates about Africa being vulnerable and likely to fall into further poverty and dependency. However, throughout the continent, we have seen so much resilience demonstrated, and some countries have done extremely well. Which economies do you think will recover quicker, and to what would they attribute that recovery?
Yes, the pandemic has exposed, I think, two portfolios by taking monies out of especially the African stock exchanges and also the bond markets. This has sort of been exacerbated by dip in remittances from abroad. Of Africans or Ugandans in our case, who are no longer sending in money as they used to. But the other thing that really changes the economy in Africa is the tourism. You know, the tourism dollars have also dried up. So this has opened up a second problem, and that is high indebtedness, all right? So you notice that because the African continent economies tend to rely heavily on commodities and extractives, recovery will be weak. And in this regard, more diverse African economies will fare much better. So a country like Kenya, which I believe is more diversified, might do well. Cote d'Ivoire, Tanzania. But I think that also much of East Africa as a region, we will see improvements in that because of the fact that there's been a little bit of diversification. And the fact that although commodities do play a part, tourism plays a part, the countries have taken on quite some debt in trying to build infrastructure. Obviously, you've got extremes like Tanzania that almost didn't acknowledge the pandemic and sort of continued with their business and tourism, I'm told, is going on. But I think that these countries, especially within East Africa, should be able to recover from the pandemic.
Okay. Thank you. In tackling the discussion further and at looking at the pandemic, but then from a perspective of your small, medium enterprises, what long-term opportunities did this COVID-19 pandemic present for our African SMEs?
Well, first of all, it's important to emphasize that COVID has been quite devastating, as I sort of alluded to in my earlier response. Millions of Africans have fallen back into poverty, and it is possible that we'll see the first recession in sub-Saharan Africa in nearly 25 years. So that's really, really not good at all. But there is a silver lining, and the silver lining is that the pandemic has exposed how overtly Africans are dependent on commodities and extractives. But it also exposes the country on the fact that they have been overly dependent on imports. And it's against this background which I think presents us with an opportunity because now we do realize that we need to do more at home. So there is a resurgence of development at home, the industrial set. We can see that governments now are placing more urgency on developing local industries, accelerating our ability to add value to exports, especially agricultural exports, that agricultural commodities that we grow quite well, and then exporting that. There's also a big opportunity to SMEs because we shouldn't be naive that SMEs are not simply coming and starting to grow just like that. I think the environment for the SMEs needs to be improved, particularly around tax incentives. I believe that infrastructure is an area where governments need to continue to do a lot of work so that the SMEs can work that well. Of course, funding for the SMEs, it's so important that these SMEs have funding. Some of it should be like mezzanine debt, but then they should be debt equity. I mean, they should be equity coming into their businesses. But I also think that one of the things that African governments need to work on is really education, so that the education systems can come up with the good skills, the new skills that are required in innovation. We at the fund, the NSSF, are playing our part. We have a high innovator program, which offers training for entrepreneurs and is also providing them with seed funding in order to improve the lives of startup companies. So a little bit of work that needs to be done, but I think that there are a lot more opportunities now, given the near catastrophic situation we've had to endure during the pandemic. I think we'll all come out of this much, much stronger.
Thanks, Richard. And we've talked about the pandemic, and of course, we know that you work in social security. What do you think the future of social security and insurance will be going forward, based on the learnings from the pandemic?
We are already seeing a rising interest in innovation around social security and insurance spurred by the pandemic. For instance, I'm aware there is a startup called Rocket Health, which was struggling before the pandemic, but has since seen significant growth. Rocket Health offers tele-insurance and health services. So anything innovative, anything that needs the telephone, anything that needs the apps, is something that we see quite becoming part of health insurance. It's an interesting case because health models have been prevailing prior to the pandemic. They were thought to be expensive, but if you can deliver them through the network, through the internet, or through the apps, they definitely will thrive. We should also expect to see an increased convergence and collaboration between the different players within the market. So banks are increasingly offering health insurance services and retirement schemes for their clients. And from the customer perspective, customers are very wary and conscious of the need to have emergency funds set aside, as the pandemic has shown people. You know, they don't save enough. Before the pandemic, they felt that they were short of cash. So I think that, definitely people are looking at how they can begin to save. And we are hoping that we can then build on these trends to create a more sustainable social security and insurance model for the future.
Moving away from the pandemic and coming back to SMEs, we recognize that SMEs are key drivers of growth. Which African economies are most likely to emerge in the next 5 years? We've previously had Africa's giants as South Africa and Nigeria, but South Africa has already experienced two recessions, and Nigeria last year experienced significant social and political challenges. Which economies do you think investors and the world should be watching right now?
Well, if I answered your question and just gave you two names, I'm sure you know I would be prophetic and I would make loads of money, but let's just talk a little bit. If you really look at GDP growth, they are the usual suspects. Countries like Rwanda, Ethiopia, Cote d'Ivoire, Senegal, and Tanzania have grown reasonably well. But I think that is not the best measure. I think that African countries to watch are those that are pursuing and pushing the boundaries of technology and digitization. I am a big believer that countries that think that way outside of the box are the ones that are going to perform a lot better. You know, your run-of-the-mill stuff will not work. So we also need to look at economies that are performing well on ease of doing business. So countries that where you can set up a business quite quickly, those will do very well. Countries which are also diversifying their manufacturing bases and improving their capacity to export, I think those will also do very well. And finally, and most importantly, human capital. In other words, countries that are actually working on providing their individuals with a good training, with a new way of thinking about things, promoting the whole issue around innovation and digitization will probably do very well. It is an important factor. So given these factors, I would hasten to look at and say that the countries that I think will be doing very well that we should be watching in no particular order should be Kenya. I think they've done some really good things on innovation. Ethiopia, especially with the new government that's there that is sort of private sector thinking. Senegal, some of the things that they're doing there. Nigeria, surprise, surprise, still in there, because I think that they're allowing their young people to really, really get involved in the development and this whole thing around innovation. Tanzania, and of course, I'd like to think Uganda should be among those countries. But certainly, I think the factors that I've sort of enumerated will put those countries in a very good state, and we can see them really growing very well.
I definitely agree in terms of countries that are thinking outside the box and just building on technology. You talked a bit earlier about remittances, and when we look at, you know, large macro studies, most of the financial flows into Africa are typically foreign direct investment, which is about $40 to $60 billion, foreign aid, which averages at about $46 billion, and of course remittances from Africans living abroad, which are reported at about $48 billion. How do you predict these inflows will behave in 2021?
Well, first of all, let me quote the World Bank. It has predicted that remittances to Africa will decline in 2021. So that's sort of expected. Number two, the estimate had been around 7%. Growth, but with the main reason being weak economic growth, employment levels in unemployment levels in the migrant host countries. So, relatively, that will happen. However, with vaccination programs starting to ramp up, I believe that there is some optimism. We are also seeing improvements in countries like the US and the UK. And the Middle East, which are hosting a lot of the Africans. So the picture for FDA, I don't think is different. Although the vaccination projects are going to help those countries, you know, there will be a lagging effect. And we believe that the impact of this will not be felt in places like Africa. So in terms of the remittances, I don't believe those remittances will begin walking through the door, even though the pandemic might be done by the end of, say, 2021. Mm-hmm. However, on the FDI side, I believe that in Africa, that will remain subdued. We know that there are fewer transactions of mergers and acquisitions taking place in Africa. They declined by almost 72% last year compared to the previous year. So I expect that to be difficult. We've also seen that there's been quite some fund managers, especially in Europe and in the US, who are beginning to trickle back into especially the bond market, largely because interest rates are still much higher here, and the currencies have not depreciated as much as they did previously during this period. So we are seeing some of that money coming back, especially to invest in the government bond programs, which obviously are towards targeted towards infrastructure development. So apart from that, I see very little FDI coming back directly for investment in equities. Although we also notice that the stock markets have been stable following the drastic fall at the beginning of the pandemic in March of last year.
Thanks, Richard. And moving right along to China and Africa's relationship and FDIs. In relation to the FDI, last year, Zambia defaulted on its sovereign obligations. The country owes China an estimated $12 billion in infrastructure development debt, which accounts for over a quarter of external liabilities. Most of the infrastructure projects across Africa could be funded directly or indirectly by China. Total debt owed to China by African countries is reported at over $140 billion. What do you see as the implications on national assets, in cases of failure to pay?
Of course, the debt problem is something we can no longer ignore. I know that, for example, apart from the example you've given of Zambia, Angola and Mozambique have debts larger than their economies. So the problem is not really restricted to Zambia. And I think that although Africa still needs to grow its infrastructure, it must learn to grow and borrow to finance this infrastructure responsibly. But debt needs to be sustainable. I always say that, if we run countries the way we run our homes, then I think the world would be in a much better place, because you would never borrow for your home much more than you had in your income, because what would end up happening, you lose your home and everything else that you've done. So, countries sort of, people don't look at them like that. So I think people who are running countries need to really think about how they run their countries, and they should be able to sustain those debts. But thankfully, there is an initiative by the World Bank, the Debt Service Suspension Initiative, DSSI, which is in place to suspend rather than write off these debts. And I'm hoping that while this offers some short-term relief, the long-term sustainability is still problematic. Just using the example from Uganda, I know that this coming financial year, we are going to pay over 20 trillion shillings in debt repayments or servicing, but we're only going to collect 45 trillion in tax revenues. I mean, you can see that already more than half of the money that is going to be collected in taxes is going to be utilized in paying back just debt. So what else can a country do in such a situation? If this was a home, as in the initial example I gave, right, we would be in real serious trouble. So what we need to see is a need for more funding of infrastructure needs, but using our own resources. And we have to confront the challenge of developing our long-term savings pool, savings, pension funds, investment clubs. Those four pools of savings are a very good way of formalizing a greater proportion of the economy in order to make sure that money is then lent onto the governments, but it's local savings, which then can be used to transform our economies. And of course, make sure that there is a huge increase in economic activity so that the tax revenues can also be increased and therefore pay for our own stuff. So I think I would say that we all need to live within our means if we are really to survive.
One of the topics that's trending at the moment is the Africa Free Trade Continental Area and Free Trade Area. And of course, Kabelo is quite passionate about talking about that. But that's a thing of 2021. There's been so many other trade unions prior. And we all know that Africa and Britain have a very long history. What overall impact do you think Brexit will have on Africa?
This is actually something that I personally was thinking about for quite a long time during the discussions and all the comedy that was going on in the British Parliament. I think we had some of the best debates around the Brexit. But I think UK's trade strategy in the wake of Brexit is a one-on-one deal trade basis. So I'm sure that we will see that there will be examples where they will wrap up the discussions on signing one-on-one deals. I know that, for example, they are talking to India at the moment to make sure that they can sign a trade deal. This will be the UK's strategy, I think, going forward, and no doubt we'll see arrangements with Africa at some point. I think that, but that will be like a little bit later. In the near term, I don't see much change happening, because as the saying goes, the UK has bigger fish to fry initially before they get to Africa. Mm-hmm. I think that its biggest trade partner that will continue to be the EU. This has consumed a lot of their time in setting up their new arrangements, including the last deal that literally signed in the last seconds before their deadline. They will have to continue to tie up those loose ends from the EU deal situation. But I also believe that they will start to deal with the places like the US. I think they, before Mr. Trump left office, there was talk about that deal. I'm sure Mr. Biden will take over those talks. China, big deal. Australia, South Africa, South Korea, before they begin looking at Africa. But I think that in the scheme of things, we will not see a lot of change in the way we do business with the UK.
Wow, interesting. Coming back home with one of our enemies as a continent, corruption. They claim Nigeria invented it, and with time, my country, South Africa, perfected it. And can I also add the Democratic Republic of Congo is breathing. But when looking at South Africa and Nigeria, both countries are making strides and reforms in trying to cap it. Which country do you think is going to be successful with these reforms, especially in such difficult economic times? And what opportunities do these challenges to doing business in Africa present?
First of all, that's a very interesting question. The fact that you can actually make those claims is just astronomical. I mean, Nigeria is very interesting, has made very interesting gains on the economic front in spite of the challenges of corruption, as I alluded to earlier in this interview. What this shows is that a new type of entrepreneur is emerging out of Africa. You know, people who totally ignore their own governments and have a global outlook, but then can continue to operate in a local context. So I think that's quite encouraging for me. We've seen also an increasing interest in Africa from foreign startups, with places like Kenya positioning themselves as the fintech hub. So I think it's against this background that it's becoming clear that corruption is primarily a leadership challenge. So it challenges leadership, especially the political leadership. But if you look at the enterprises, you know, if people are serious enough, they can create enterprises that will sort of circumvent corruption. Of course, corruption means that service delivery is not done, and therefore a lot of the work that needs to be done has to be done by the private sector. Where find a setup and a place where it is clear that that we need to become primarily sort of change this environment. I think entrepreneurs will be attracted to places with few operating constraints. So rather than going into a place where there's corruption, they will go there. But so long as they can set up the businesses quite quickly, corruption doesn't affect that side of things, then I'm sure you'll find that they'll be fine. Where else, if they can find talent, if they can meet the costs of doing businesses within those environments, I think then corruption sort of, you know, is sort of sidestepped. But I think corruption is still a major cost to businesses. And if governments are unable to see that it that way, they will lose out on investment and growth. So while institutions, laws, and even technology can be put in place to address this vice, I think the biggest leverage we can benefit from is good leadership, leadership free of corruption. And I think how seriously the leadership takes this issue, I'm not too sure. The jury is still out on this particular one.
Thank you, Richard. I have a bonus question for you, and it's on a country that we're all looking at and watching at the moment. And that's none of your big bets in terms of growth. It is Zimbabwe. What can we learn from Zimbabwe pre-Mugabe and post-Mugabe? Especially because the continent still has a lot of social and political pressures ongoing. And so, you know, many people have seen, Zimbabwe in the 90s versus Zimbabwe in the 2000s and Zimbabwe today. What are the key learnings and what is it to watch from Zimbabwe at the moment?
I think the biggest challenge with Zimbabwe has been around land. The challenge with the land is that the government made a decision to sort of remove the land from the people who were making maximum use of it. and sort of gave it to the population, which isn't a bad thing. It's only that the population, I don't believe, were ready to take on this land. The example I always give is in my own country, where land has been fragmented, you know, because land is owned normally by family. You know, once you have a couple of kids, you break up the land, you give it each of them, and slowly and surely that land becomes inefficient. The production, you know, a lot of the kids have different ideas what to do. So what they end up doing is that they sell the land so that they can get a bit of money, and then they go to the, they migrate into the city. But then because the city is now getting so many people, they hadn't planned for it. So that rural urban migration is totally uncontrolled. And I think that that's really the problem of Zimbabwe, the fact that they really messed up the policy of on land. It's no longer producing. And then that followed through in all the facets of the country. The fact that now there isn't sufficient food, then you need to begin importing food. When you are a net exporter of food, your markets, of course, get disrupted. So I think it's a classic case of how not to be able to sort of liberalize your land and give it back to the owners or the local natives without having a significant plan. So I would say that certainly the country still has the potential, but leadership is also quite important. They need to put in place policies that sort of rejuvenates this. They need to take into consideration all the things that are broken and how to be able to fix them. And I think that their financial markets are one of the places to start in. Also trying to give incentives to some of the local startups and making sure that they take advantage of digitization and improve on the delivery of services to their citizens through almost empowering the population to get back into that mode of innovation, creating, finding new ways of doing things, solving things that, like education, solving things like their health facilities, and basically getting the country back on shape. Of course, looking at their borrowing and how they can collect taxes and sort of pay for their stuff without necessarily having to go abroad, and rejuvenating things like their mineral sector, because that's one area where they had lots of advantage over the rest of Africa. I would say that if they were to rejuvenate that, get decent mining concessions to those countries so that they can begin to get revenues into their coffers so they can pay for stuff to develop their country.
Thank you so much, Richard. Any closing remarks in terms of what 2021 might look like across Africa?
I'm quite hopeful around 2021. I believe that the countries that pick the lessons, the countries that prepared quite well, the countries that drove their populations to think outside of the box, the countries that embraced digitization and the new way of doing things, using data to improve on their service delivery, those are the countries that will continue to perform quite well and attract new resources in the continent. And I believe that it's the year when the continent will recover from this horrible pandemic.
All right. Thank you so much. In the seat today, we had Richard Biarugaba, Managing Director for the NSSF, talking about what 2021 might look like based on pre-existing trends across the region and, of course, recovery from the pandemic. Thank you.